I basically is about to appear.
Oh, really?
In printed form.
Oh, really?
A book is about to appear.
Oh, really?
Of essays.
Yes.
Collected by Hardy as usual.
Yes.
Now that contains a long piece about, which is very cowling of book, which is about the Mestre, mm-hmm. which I never thought worth publishing. Mm-hmm. It's 80 pages of this, of enormous length. I've corrected it.
Yes.
I've done my best with it. Henry Hardy marvelously looked up all the passages, gave all the references are there, mm-hmm. and he removed a certain number of repetitions, mm-hmm. which was always there, and that will be published as part of this book, mm-hmm. which is to be called The Crooked Timber of Humanity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Why did you fix on that title?
Oh, because it's my favorite quotation from Kant. I told you, I think.
No.
Oh, well, there's a wonderful quotation in Kant, which I've preserved in my bosom all these years. Out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing can ever be made. Very much, I believe.
Yes, yes.
Really is. And he said it to all people.
It's rigid, yes, yes, absolutely.
It's severe, rationalist thinker, you see.
Yes.
I was the Krummen Holz der Menschheit. Something like, it's not quite an exact translation. I heard Collingwood deliver that in the lecture. That's where I got it from.
Right.
One of the minor essays. Mm-hmm. One of Kant's smaller essays, you see.
Yes.
This wonderful statement comes.
It is wonderful.
You see, and there's real truth in it. Yes. My other favorite quotation, which has not come into this book, is, it comes somewhere. That's one of those things. There is no reason to suppose that the truth, when it is discovered, will prove interesting. That is said by C.I. Lewis, who was an American pragmatist philosopher. Very good deflationist people. It's enough if it's true.
Yes, yes.
Pursuit of the truth must not depend on supposing it's interesting.
Hello, hello.
Would you give us a little coffee or something?
Yes, certainly.
Your kindness.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's something to do with the glands or whatever they are. Mm.
Could I? I'm sorry to be tedious or thick, but I've thought about that analogy about the clock's hands being nailed, and I've not understood why it's solace. I've not all I see is an exceptionally sort of Kafkaesque and beautiful image.
No, I can tell you.
But I don't understand what it means.
It means something. No, it's very brilliant. It really has a meaning. Mm. You see, for a solipsist, everything which happens is the product of himself, his own impressions, his own wishes. There's nothing else in the world. Everything which occurs is in some way generated by him.
Yes.
Or created by him, even if he doesn't know it.
Yes.
But if you would say, what difference does that make to anything?
Yes.
Supposing it were true, what would it actually come to?
Yes.
What is the cash value, as William James used to say, of that?
Yes.
I mean, what difference is there? You see, if you think that everything is your thoughts, then presumably by stopping to think, you destroy the universe. All right.
Yes.
But who can tell it?
Yes.
So it's not very verifiable. The point is that everything else remains the same. You simply put the whole world into a bracket.
Yes.
Yourself outside the bracket. What's inside the bracket is unaltered.
Yes.
And then it comes to nothing. I'll tell you the analogy.
Yes.
Supposing you say, there's an elephant in this room. And you say, I can't see it. It's invisible. I can't touch it. It's untouchable.
But it's there.
But it's there. You see? Then you say, well, but I mean, does it trumpet? Yes, but it's inaudible. Then you have to say, well, what do you mean by elephant? It's perhaps not quite right what I mean by elephant. I think what you mean by elephant is what I call empty space. But it's not an elephant.
Mm.
Well, now, that's like solipsism. If there's no way, if the presence of the elephant makes no difference to anything at all, if everything remains totally unaltered.
Yes.
You see?
Mm.
You see? Then it isn't a doctrine at all.
Yes.
Then you're saying nothing.
Yes.
You just use the word elephant in a perfectly empty way.
Yes.
It's not clear that, you see, what is it? In other words, what supposing we said, theoretically has gone from this room, what would the difference be?
Yes.
How would you know? How would anyone know? How would anyone be able to think of this room? And so on. What would be, let alone verification, what would be, let's speak, what difference would it make? Mm-hmm. To anything we can possibly see, hear, think, believe, religiously, intuit, or anything else.
Yes.
If no difference is made, it's vox nihili, something.
Yes.
We're saying nothing, we're just uttering sounds.
Mm-hmm.
This is true about solipsism in a way. You see, you can't disprove it. You see, everything. Fichte disproved it by something quite simple. He said, if you believe that everything is a product of your mind, if somebody insults you, I didn't think I was under the impression that you're insulting yourself.
It's rather good, yeah.
Yeah. We'll see if it really, but Wittgenstein's point is that the clock faces the world.
Mm-hmm.
The time remains the same. In other words, nothing alters in the function of the clock. The purpose of the clock is to show the time.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the phase goes round makes no difference to time. The fact that you think that everything is the product of your mind makes no difference to anything at all.
Yes.
Things remain exactly where they were before.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say, because it's the product of your mind, I can tamper with it.
Yes.
I can stop it. All you can say is, if I commit suicide, the world will disappear. Nothing will be else. Say that if you like, means nothing. Because there is some sense in which, I mean, it's not clear what you really mean by world. It's all you really mean is yourself again.
Yes.
Well, if you identify yourself with the world, you can, but it isn't meaningful.
That's how we can suit you.
That's what well, that's about.
It's a very clever image.
Very clever image. I saw him again once again in Oxford. He did finally come to the talk he never had before.
Mm-hmm.
At all, first thing. I remember he said somewhere in the middle of something, I have an ascending curve. I'd like to go and talk. Where can I talk tomorrow morning? I remember the ascending curve.
Yes.
He was supposed to talk about cogito ergo sum, Descartes. Someone, Professor Pritchard, then his last leg said, I wonder, Professor Wittgenstein, mind saying, whether he thinks that cogito ergo sum is true or false, which is it, in his view? You know, it's an honest. I didn't come here to talk about Descartes. Honest, I didn't. That's how I talk. He then said, I'm an ascending curve.
Yes.
I leave you. There's yours. There's two boxes.
You don't take yours with.
No, I do. Like. I'm trying to think.
When you told this story before, you told me that Wittgenstein and his disciples were dressed in an extraordinary manner.
Yes, they were. They had to have leather on their elbows. And we used flannel trousers and that kind of thing. But this is a very simple version. He dressed like that, so did they.
Why do you think it was that in the Cambridge environment, no notice was taken whatever of the coming of the debacle in France? Whereas in Oxford there was...
Well, because it is in some of any philosophers, I can't tell you, philosophers, like in any testify by the philosophers.
Yeah.
Cambridge was always much more remote from the world, and rather proud of it.
Yes.
Oxford is more worldly. Cambridge is more self-contained and self-absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
There's a greater more mutual admiration in Cambridge, a greater more scepticism in Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
Oxford on the whole is rather worldly, and as it were, they kept in touch with society, London, this and that. Cambridge kept itself pure, high-minded, puritanical, so on. There's an element of that. That's why communism was so much more intense in Cambridge than in Oxford.
Yes.
All
it's another kind of unworldliness.
Yes, well,
another kind of Puritanism as well.
Yeah, well, fanatic, I mean, sort of building with life.
According to
the true ideas. I mean, when Keynes and company, so that Moore really gave them all their moral ideas, they all believed. Principia Ethica. It was the first true word said about ethics. This was, in as it were, the truth. Nobody in Oxford ever thought anything was the truth. And that's why I come from Oxford, not from Cambridge. I mean, must have something to do with it.
Yes.
I think if I'd been in Cambridge, I'd have believed all kinds of things.
But how do you explain that difference, that skeptical temper of Oxford? Yeah. What is it about the sociology of the institution?
Cowling is quite right. Conservative university. Mm-hmm. Traditionally.
Yes.
Not part science. Some, but not something like Cambridge. No traditional scientific rationalism. Mm-hmm. A Tory university. Mm-hmm. Conservative, religious, and therefore in with the powers that be.
Yes.
Some extent to the whether we go Tory.
And therefore worldly.
Therefore
skeptical.
Cambridge was always said undermining all that. It was a tradition of science and Puritan, right, anyhow. Utilitarian in science, friendly to science versus humanity, if you like, I mean, but in the Oxford sense, Greek and Latin, the classical world, being a gentleman. Never a Cambridge ideal.
Yes.
Cambridge produces poets, and Oxford produces politicians.
Hmm.
You can't deny it.
Another person to change the subject radically. Just to fill out my roster of your acquaintances and things, is your friend David Cecil and what he, how you knew him? And
was a very clever and very, very clever and man of absolutely irresistible charm, personally. Highly intelligent, full of charm, imagination, and very good talker. He very much in the tradition of his family.
You'll have to tell me what the tradition of his family was.
Well, this was. I'll tell you, it really started with the Prime Minister. I mean, God knows, Elizabethan Cecil and then the other there. They were always the centre of the English aristocracy since the 16th century. They felt themselves to be in some way in charge of England.
Yes.
You see? The Prime Minister, the soldier, was exactly conservative in the sense in which perhaps Oakeshott thinks it ought to be. That's why it's called Salisbury Review. He was once asked, under what circumstances goes to war? To which he said, well, we never can tell. You go, come out of your front door and you look. You wonder whether you take an umbrella or not. You look at the sky. May rain, may not. You decide either to take an umbrella or not to take it. That's one goes to war. You just make up your mind.
Yes.
You have to plump.
Yes.
That's a very Sicily sort of view. Well, he also said something that Winston Churchill once repeated in my presence, I've never heard otherwise. There are only two methods of government, bamboozle or bamboo. It's very funny.
What did he mean?
Well, clearly, I mean...
Yeah, I know what bamboozle is, but bamboo...
Bamboo means force.
Yeah.
Sticks. Bamboo means you force you on the natives.
Yes.
Beat them up. They do something wrong. Whip them. Bamboo's a bamboo. But yes, but never thought they do. David was like that. At point was even skeptical conservative. But they were very patriotic. They were anti-Roman Catholic. They were Church of England. They were religious. He had these four uncles. One was the Bishop of Exeter. One was Robert Cecil, founder of the League of Nations, or at least one of his early creators, mm-hmm. with Gilbert Murray and people like that. One was Hugh Cecil, an extreme conservative. Because if you think, mm-hmm. read a book on real ideologist conservatism, mm-hmm. who believed that, what did he believe? He believed, that something Whitman, he didn't think freedom was a right. He thought freedom was a privilege.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds,
yes, that's
that
what
sounds
he was
like
in.
The right thing.
That's what he was. He thought virtue is, he had a conversation with his young nephew, David, he's called Uncle Linky, I think. They went for a walk, he was 10, David, to which Hugh Cecil, his uncle, Lord Hugh, said, oh, boy, what do you think makes a good man? To which David Cecil said, well, I don't know, it's somebody who tries to make other people happy. Nonsense, boy. Any competent, licensed fiddler can do that.
It's wonderful, inspired remark. That is really the voice of a grandee.
Yeah. Competent. Yeah. Competent, licensed whittler. That's what they used to be called, food merchants.
Yes, indeed.
As you know, you see, wonderful remark can make people happy. That is not the point of being good.
Yes.
Being good is obeying the law, yes. Being God, I think.
Yes.
Well, here was this prominent political family, and in the house, in what's it called, in
Hatfield House?
What? Hatfield. So then this political conversation. I mean, by lunch and dinner, they all interrupted each other. They all talked about politics very freely.
Yes.
And the children were allowed to talk about it. It's complete freedom of conversation. Nothing pompous. Nothing grand people could interrupt. You could tell jokes. And politics was of the essence of that household.
Yes.
And the old Prime Minister was not at all solemn or grand in that way, you see, and that's the atmosphere in which he grew up. But he was aesthetically minded and took an interest in literature. He didn't think he ever said anything very original, as far as literature is concerned, but he put it extremely well. He was great charm, precision of language, and so on, you see, but he wasn't a contributor to, that's why he was despised by the Cambridge gurus. And Levy thought he was nothing. And all they were just a chat, causeries, just sort of agreeable talk, like his father-in-law, Desmond McCarthy. Same sort of thing.
Yes.
He was kind of fellow traveller of Bloomsbury, not quite. He thought Bloomsbury was a bit ridiculous. But he was very sensible, had a lot of common sense, and very tough.
Why tough? And
well,
why
just was tough.
But give me an example of where you suddenly felt he was very tough.
Well, no nonsense. If anyone said something which was obviously absurd, he had no patience with it. He didn't know, he was very polite, he was very courteous, but he brushed it aside in a very firm way. They were with it. When the war came, they were madly anti-Munich, as a family.
Yes.
I mean, there's no question, even with Hitler, had he stood up to England, he could protect, defend it, sort of tough. Tough in the sense that he wasn't sentimental. That's what I meant by tough, I think.
Yeah.
In no way sentimental, nothing gooey. He was a straight conservative. He wrote a letter to the Times, agreeing with his friend, A.L. Rouse, in the 30s, 20s almost, that there was a class war, but he was on the other side. It's perfectly true. The classes were fighting each other. He He was on the side of the capitalists. Yeah. Quite firmly declared himself. Mm. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
When violently anti-egalitarian.
But you got on nonetheless, because
very good,
you're not.
Yes.
You're
as old as my best friend in Oxford, one time. He was more delightful to talk to than anybody I ever met. We talked for hours.
Yes. Well,
we
what
talked
do you
about
think,
anything.
What do you think
Fox
was the
people.
Nature of your bond? I mean, why did you...
Trust there, trust. Ability to give each other pleasure of some sort. And if we could talk about books, about people, about situations, and we were both quite new, we amused each other, and we fundamentally agreed about what people were like,
yeah.
what made them attractive or unattractive, about ordinary, so to speak, appreciation. Or politically, we weren't agreed. We knew that. There was one time when I had a quarrel with him, and it nearly broke our relationship.
And that was over?
That was over. The appointment of a fellow in English in New College, when he ceased to be. You see, he was a very good tutor, quite a lot of, I mean, English tutors, because he encouraged everybody. So whenever they said anything, he said, oh, that's very interesting. You should say that. But it wasn't at all. You see, but do develop this a little. Oh, I don't think I ever thought of that. But do tell me, what do you mean? Do you mean this or that? Oh, I'm very interested. That's quite original. He said it to the stupidest pupils,
yes,
whom it certainly encouraged.
Yes.
He was very good at that, bringing people out. John Bailey is his faithful, devoted disciple.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, when the question of fellowship came up, one of the various candidates, and I had a friend called Humphrey House, who was a rather heavy, left-wing editor of Hopkins and Dickens' letters, and believed in social aspects of literature. He wrote a book called The Dickens World, which was about the poor,
yes,
so to speak, and the journal, so to speak, and Parliament at that time, and the journal, so to speak, condition of England at that period. David Cecil did not believe in that in the British literature at all. He believed that the purpose of being either a literary critic or a teacher of literature was to be like somebody in the conservatoire, to understand how people created and to teach other people how to create.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You had to be rather like, as I say, somebody teaching composition.
Yeah.
Sounds like American creative writer almost.
Yeah.
Some Virginia Woolf was his ideal critic, because she understood the intuitive sense of what writers were like or how they created, gave her the impression she knew what the actual creative process was. But the idea of analysis, first of all, relation to social events, social background, so-called,
yeah.
or scholarship, which is exact knowledge of who said what when and whether so-and-so influenced so-and-so. He didn't mind these people. He thought it rather boring.
Yeah.
All these professors in Oxford who developed very elaborate.
Yeah.
But he was quite a friend of C.S. Lewis. He said, the great thing about Lewis, I can tell you, he's a pre-Raphaelite. What they liked, he likes. Quite easy to make him out.
Yes.
It was exactly the truth.
Yes.
They liked Dante, he liked Dante. They liked Ariosto, he liked Ariosto.
Yes.
They liked Chaucer, he liked Chaucer. He happened to be, so to speak, after his time. He happened
yes.
to live in 1860.
Yes, yes.
It happened to be true.
Yes.
Nobody else ever said that. He was rather good at
seeing things
in this way.
Yes.
I mean, putting his finger on it.
Yes.
Well.
You had a disagreement about
Houses. Disagreement was
about
candidates. Now, there were various candidates with him. There was somebody called Robson, who was in fact a pupil of his office, became quite an important professor of literature. Someone from Glasgow, someone came back to Oxford and named quite an original, interesting thing. Then there was, there was John Wayne, who was in Reading, the pupil of C.S. Lewis.
Yeah.
There were various other people. But the man he wanted, the man who was appointed, who was Michael Buxton, who was an English gentleman, who did a bit of shooting, knew about Spencer, I think, and it struck him as somebody with a natural taste for literature and amateurs in a way. He hated professionalism.
Yes.
And this is what was still, really. So then he came to me one morning, I was still in bed, we began talking. What, in his opinion, the qualities necessary. And then he developed this theme about the conservatoire. But they have to be like teachers in the musical sense. You see, and I said, I totally disagreed. I thought Sam Bird was all right. Edmund Wilson, whom he dismissed totally. Mm. All this business about who they were, why they wrote as they wrote, what the social influences were, what their personal character was. Well, he didn't want to deny it entirely. But I could see this was unfriendly. He wanted purely aesthetic approach, which ultimately comes to Oakeshott. It ultimately means some kind of delicate tracing.
Intimation.
Delicate tracing of the actual creative literary process. But it never threw any light on anything, really. His best book was on Thomas Hardy. But he's rather good that way. But he was rather good, he was a clever man. I once asked him about Carlyle, for example. He said, well, I'll tell you about Carlyle, it's very interesting. You see, he wrote this book on Frederick the Great, because he thought he was a fine old German of a powerful kind, very much not kind of feeble, liberal, you know, secret encyclopedist, rational, sort of, with these dry, rational utilitarian thinkers, but a master of men. Then he discovered that Frederick the Great didn't talk German, wanted to talk French. Greatly admired Voltaire, greatly admired all the people whom Carlyle didn't like at all. And they cracked the book in the middle, and it doesn't come off. Mm. It is correct. Mm. Nobody ever said that. Mm. But on this occasion, we really had a row. Mm. And I wondered, Humphrey, how does he didn't like him? And then I was away when the actual election occurred in America. And somebody said, what about Humphrey? How is this now interesting book on Dickens' world? And David said, apparently, I wasn't there. Oh, it is of great interest. It's a very interesting book, of course, yes. But what I ask myself is, where are the laughter and the tears? You see? Yeah. And that's very typical. And that was no good. Yeah. That's where the break occurred. We made friends, all right. We continued on after the very happily. Buxton was a great failure.
Yeah.
He was learned, he was hardworking. But the point, great thing is he lived outside Oxford. He did a bit of shooting. He was a tremendous gent.
Yes.
And old-fashioned conservative, yeah. Or rigid kind.
Cecil was choosing someone in his own image.
As near as you could get. Yeah. He was probably somewhere, yes. Yes. He was pleased by anybody who had life or imagination.
Yes.
But in the end, he voted for the Conservative Party. Couldn't be helped.
Yeah. Did that row damage your friendship, or did it
for a
seal
bit,
over?
For a bit, because I went to America then, and I came back, we didn't talk about it. It all became more of me. Mm-hmm. And Bucks was there, and he left him. Mm-hmm. I never spoke to him. But a pupil of mine, that was the point, I knew he was no good. Mm-hmm. I tried to be philosopher.
When did David Cecil die?
When Stuart Hampshire had been elected. He was an adulterer. Technically, because he went off with Mrs. Eyre, Freddie's wife, who refused to marry him a long time, and they weren't married. So, the question is, could we elect a fellowship? A man who'd sinned in this awful way.
Yeah.
He was then doing what? I think he was doing something, civil services. Then. No, in London. London University.
Through Hampshire.
Yeah, teaching.
Yeah.
The question was, somebody made a speech against him on those grounds. Buxton did. After that, a man called Dorothy of the Old Fashioned, who had an organist who was a Northern Irishman, an extreme, a rigid sort of, imagine, Ulster Protestant,
yeah.
Called Andrews, whose cousin was the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, and so on. He said he couldn't see how young men could be taught by men of the new monarchy. The question was, well, because my lot were in favour. And then David Cecil, then the vote happened. David Cecil was banned into divorce. Thought divorced people ought not to be married in chapel ever again.
Mm-hmm.
And all that, you see, marriage was a sacrament. And therefore, strongly protested against that sort of thing. Began raising his hand for him, then dropped it. And half raised it again. Didn't want to be out with us.
Yeah.
We were his friends.
Yeah.
He didn't want to appear a terrible reaction.
Yeah.
On the other hand, he didn't has accepted his own Anglican position.
Yes.
The chaplain was wonderful on that occasion. It was a man called, a dissenter, somebody wrote famous memoirs, what is his name? Famous late 18th century or early 19th memoir, whatever, somebody lived in the country. What's his name? Famous was often suddenly discovered by somebody who exquisite accounts of life by clergymen in the country.
Yes, I know who you mean.
You know what I mean.
I do know exactly.
Woodford.
Woodford, Parson Woodford.
Parson Woodford, well, this was very descendant.
All right.
Who said, you know, I think adultery is a sin. I think it's a sin, undoubtedly a sin. But you know, there are sins worse than that, or at least equally bad, he said. Malice, cruelty, wickedness of every sort. Yet that doesn't stand in the way people have made fellows of colleges. Yeah. Why should we pick on this?
Well, wonderful. Well said.
From
well
a chaplain.
Said.
From a chaplain. Yeah.
But that didn't sway Cecil
eccentric.
In his vote.
In the end, I think he didn't vote. Didn't vote. Mm. What?
You don't want to go to Electra.
Electra?
Yes.
Not the least. Why do you ask?
I don't know, because it's the only way I'm going to them. I
wanted
to
suffer so it's
our duty. It was our duty to go.
You can't hear anything from me about this business. Mm-hmm. Something quite different. I'm going to tell you two stories, one long and one extremely short.
Mm-hmm.
The long story is this. There's a man called Kralin, who I think has written the letters with very large handwriting about Ahmadova. He's some sort of editor of a work. He's a kind of literaturoved.
Yeah.
He has written an article. Whether I answered the letters, I can't tell you. I have a friend called McCain, who translates Ahmadova, translates Pasternak, and is Turkish.
Mm-hmm.
And he commits suicide about twice a year, and then has to be saved and sent to, sent to hospital and comes back. He's quite nice, he's very disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
But he's quite a good translator and quite a nice man.
Mm-hmm.
But he'll never come to me very much. Anyway, I've known him for years, and he comes and talks to me about poetry, sends me all his translations. Turkish, he really knows very well. There's a lot of Turkish poets. Mm-hmm. Eccentric, but harmless. He knows this man in Moscow, Leningrad, sorry. Now he's some kind of literary bloke, and he has written an article called Sir Isaiah Berlin and Anna Ahmadova, in which he maintained it hasn't been published. And I don't think I was meant to see it, but he sent it to my friend to look at.
Who passed it on?
My friend then showed it to me. And I said, look, don't tell him that I've seen it because it'll spoil your originalism. But I might as well tell you, in which he maintains the following. First of all, I'm described as, the question is, why did Ahmadova, how could she like me at all? Why could this affect? Being what I am, being what she is. And it begins rather rudely. It says, well, I'm quite good talker, gavarun. Gavarun means chatterbox. It's impolite.
Yes.
It's not quite as bad as boltun, which means also chatterbox. Gavarun means, talk.
Yes.
That's what I mean, it's contemptuous.
Yes.
And what I describe about my visit is this. He talked to a woman called Sofia Kazimirovna Ostrovska, who's a Pearl biologist, who was apparently a friend of Ahmad, who's written a book about her, I mean, conversation, which I've never read, translated by a woman called Jesse somebody, who sent me something on Ahmadova, which I vaguely wrote a nice letter about. Memoirs, which have been translated into English, which I might look at. Didn't seem very interesting to me. This woman says that when I arrived in Ahmadova's rooms, you remember the story, she was there, because Ahmadova asked her to come because she knew English, and was thought that, because I was described on the telephone as a professor from Oxford, who is a sort of specialist on Russian literature or some nonsense.
Yeah.
And this man says, Well, he's not that. He's a sociologist of some, who is quite well-known sociologist in England, but it doesn't matter for this one. You see, anyway, she said she was present in case an interpreter wanted. And that I report that Ahmada was wearing a white shawl. It is not true. She was wearing a tattered Chinese dress. Well, she may be right. I wouldn't quarrel about that.
But then, you do remember her as being there.
I remember somebody as there. I say in my piece, there's a woman of academic appearance.
Yes.
I had no idea who she was.
Yes,
I report that. Could have been her, yes. Then I say to Ahmadova, I'm very glad you're alive, and they haven't heard very much about you in the West. They can so glad I'll be able to. And she said, oh. And articles about me is written in the Dublin Review, and there's a thesis being written about me in Bologna, which I report. She said nothing of the kind. Well, I couldn't have invented that.
No.
It's a little too strange.
Yes.
I mean, however mendacious I may be,
yes.
Dublin Review in Bologna.
Yes. Yes.
Must have been said by somebody.
Yes.
So that's really wrong. Then came the rant of Churchill, this awful episode, and I left. Then I came back in the evening. She was there, she says, with another woman called Hunter. There was another woman there, who was a seriologist, who I described, who was a pupil of Ahmadova's second husband, who was a man called Shideko, who wasn't a seriologist. This woman was not present. She says she was there, and the other woman was there, and Gumilov was there, the son.
Mm-hmm.
And we all had dinner together.
Yeah.
We had this, we had that, we had sort of, I don't know, fish, potatoes, delicious bread and so on. Nothing, there was no meal of any kind. At
right.
that point. There was only one woman there throughout.
Right.
She claims all this.
Right.
And she says, I keep on saying to the man in his article, I didn't invent it. I was certainly there. Then, after we talked a long time, Anta thought she couldn't go home by herself, was frightened of the empty streets. So I said I'd come with her. And Berlin accompanied us to the gate of the Sheremetyev Palace. Then went back. I didn't accompany anyone to any gate.
Mm.
She wasn't there,
no.
The woman left, I had no idea where she was going.
Yeah.
None of this. It's unimportant.
Yeah.
None of this is true. Then, he says, the poems written about our visit are called Cinque. Cinque because he called them five times. He combined them. He squeezed that into two visits, simply for the sake of literary sort of thought. But, of course, he stayed a month in Leningrad. I stayed 2 days. This the NKVD could testify to that.
Yes.
You see what I mean?
Mm.
He was there for a month and he certainly called him five times. That's why it's called Cinque. Well, it's called Cinque because it's five poems.
Mm.
Good enough reason.
Mm.
There's no need to climb walls about that.
Yes.
Anyway, therefore, he's an unreliable memoir writer.
Right.
What he says cannot be true. Moreover, he's clearly not very truthful because there's a verse in Ahmadova, apropos of me, presumably. Saying, you have imagined me. Someone like me could never resist. You've invented me, imagined me. Таких на свете нет. People like that don't exist in the world. Well, it's very clever that means. But what he thinks it means is, I'm just a liar, inventor, maker up of things. What she means is that I had a romantic vision of her.
Yes.
And people like that didn't exist. I had some kind of, I had some bemused eyes. I saw in some ideal light.
That's
all that means.
Yes.
Very clear.
Yes.
Not mean to any reader. However, it's an awful piece. He then goes on to say, well, I maybe will write my own job in Oxford, but as a memoir writer, not you. Then, have I got anything to add to my piece? Because now, bits of poems out here have been published, new fragments have published, and that is somebody who does call them, also five times. So the five is repeated, which shows clearly that it's been a month in Leningrad. It's an absurd piece of a very hostile kind.
Yes.
Not very, but hostile. Now, I didn't know what to do, so I told my friend, look, you haven't shown it to me, but if you're going there, as he intended to, you can tell him all these things are inaccurate. He would list of inaccuracies.
Yes.
She probably didn't put down to exactly. But he never did go to Leningrad. He was going, but he's now going in April. I don't know what happens. I mean, the article appears. But I would rather like to know, because I can answer it.
Yes.
So I've complained about it to the old Chukovskaya.
All right.
In Moscow.
All right.
And she said he's a noble man. He's, I said, who is, yes. No, I got a woman to ring her up. Yes. I didn't know. I said, what about Chukovskaya's daughter, it was. What about this woman, Sofia Kazimirovna? She said, oh, we called her Akhmatova's waste paper basket. Just flung things she didn't want, wanted to get rid of on her. Mm-hmm. Also, she's dead. No one really remembers. Yes. Well, that's all. Yes. So sooner or later, I could see something would have to be said to express some skepticism.
Yes, indeed.
This is some kind of jealousy on the part of other Akhmatovists. Yes. How could I remember all these things 40 years before? Well, that's a reasonable question.
Yes.
But the answer is, as I told a lot of people about it in detail,
and
I came, the thing came out of my heart, practically, as a version.
Indeed.
Now that's my long story. Mm. My short story is that I received a letter about 2 weeks ago, a little more, from somebody in Moscow, which said, in Russian, greatly respected Sir Isaiah Berlin, written to Sir Isaiah Berlin, Oxford University, Oxford. I am the daughter of your father's youngest sister. She then gives the details, which are absolutely interesting. Her name is Asya, and it's quite true, I never knew my father's youngest sister. But she lived in Bobruisk, town somewhere near Minsk or something.
Yeah.
Her husband maybe is what. This is not the idea what he did. They're both long dead. I am in a state of considerable anxiety. Should this anxiety become sharpened, may I rely upon your support? Yours sincerely. Signed, Asya Saurovna Kabishcheva. It's a very odd name.
Yes.
I mean, the sharp part is all right. Kabish. That's all. She's a genuine cousin, right? Perfectly good first cousin.
Yes. God.
I don't know what it means. It must mean anti-Semitism.
Yes.
You can imagine it.
Yes.
Nothing else. So I wrote her a letter saying, of course, she can and all that. It takes a month to get the idea that she'll get it.
Yes.
What I'm going to ask you in May, in case nothing happens.
Is to
telephone. I don't know her telephone number.
And look her up.
But her address I know. Yes. Not just look her up. But at least talk to her. She only talks Russian.
Yes.
Or get somebody.
Talk
to her. Yes. And give her my telephone number.
Yes, I will.
And see, I'd be happy. Give me her what?
I'd be happy. To.
Whoever she is.
Yes. In fact, Grant.
She must be 70. I mean,
Grant, a magazine, wants to send me to Moscow in May on the date of his expected pogrom.
On
the 5th of May.
5th. You go there.
In order to investigate and report on it. And as a great grandson of all these frightful people, who could be better chosen?
Back to your great grandfather.
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, I thought I'd tell you this story.
Well, thank you.
You've seen the correspondence in TLS, have you?
Yes, very well.
My Philippic you saw.
Yes, I saw your Philippic.
You saw the answer?
No, I didn't.
Oh, you should have looked
at it.
There's an answer by the victim.
Joseph Probertje.
Yes.
Oh.
And there's another letter by some lady who, wait a bit, an answer by him, there's a letter by somebody else not supporting my position in that of Gifford, and there's a letter by Sasha Pietigorsky. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't know who that is.
Pietigorsky
is his name. He is an Indologist in the London School of in Suez. He's a Buddhist. Mm-hmm. He's a Jew, a Russian Jew. And it's a very passionate letter saying, why shouldn't one renounce one's nationality? What's wrong? Why does this man attack Pasternak? After all, nobody complained but Joyce denounced Ireland and so on. You see, and a poet is a poet. What does this do? I mean, one can renounce one's religion, one's country, one's race. I mean, it's perfectly good things to do. I do. And I'm a Jew too. And so on, holding up. That's frankly absurd to have something against Pasternak because he didn't, and so on. That kind of thing. Rather emotional.
Yes. Are you going to reply to that one?
I know him. He's quite a nice man, but rather eccentric. I thought I might say on a postcard, but it may not even do that. Mm-hmm. I think I'll do that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I read your original philippic, but yes. I haven't heard. I didn't trace the reply, but I will get the reply.
Frank Kermode.
Oh, really?
Who said that he himself thought a bit scandalous of you. But it was a future with a very valuable man. One shouldn't be against him. We need him.
Oh.
He's an excellent critic. Oh. He's very, so he's obviously very structuralist, something Kermode
likes. Yes.
He must be a disciple of somebody.
Yes.
Telling him not to be against him.
Yes. Back off.
He's a professor in Sussex.
Yes. Right.
And he says in his letter that he told the editor that he knew no Russian.
Right.
In spite of which.
Right.
He sent these books for review. I have complained to Triglav, saying I'm sure you couldn't have known that he knew Russian. Sure that's label. Mm-hmm. Yeah, quite an interesting piece by him.
Yes.
In the last.
Yes, I'm gonna check them out.
Do.
I have to run.